Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we've got a great episode here for you tonight. We're going to be talking a little bit about logistics. Don't fall asleep yet, though, folks, because there's a lot that goes into this that makes our response and our preparation for disaster supremely important. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. But first, we have to get into talking with the person who is the logistical mastermind behind the podcast, Sam Bradley.
Well, I would have called you that, Jamie, but that's okay. I appreciate it. Well, things are warming up a bit out here in Colorado, so I don't have no complaints for the meteorologists, who are both off and running somewhere tonight. So we'll have to have you go to your weather app for that. We also have Kevin Ryder, our good friend, who is always pops in at the last minute if I need him, from Wild Safety. Hi, Kev.
How you guys doing?
Good. You want to kind of remind people who you are and what you do?
I'm Kevin, and I do stuff. That's the really, really a short version.
That's a good bio right there.
I teach wilderness medicine, essential outdoor skills, and I'm still working on my soon-to-be-released first-ever online course.
Ooh, can't wait for that.
So, yeah, I will definitely share that when it's all ready to go.
Well, we are going to have an interesting conversation tonight because we don't talk much about logistics, for one, and kind of what happens after, you know, you're used to hearing about me from DMAT and Joe from USAR, but what happens after that? Is it just chaotic mess or what? And in some cases, it is. And so Brian knows how to take care of that. So Brian Sims, I love his bio, and I'm going to actually give it to you because there's some things I want him to refer back to. But Brian was in the U.S. Army Infantry in 2010, and then he started studying social work. Interesting transition. But right about that same time, he started volunteering for Team Rubicon, who we know very well. And after that, he was a PIO and communications manager for the state of Florida, program operations manager for the state of Hawaii. That's got to be terrible. And was the Region 4 deputy manager of program operations. Then he studied emergency management, or maybe before that, I hope. He also has extensive experience within the DHS, FEMA, ICS, all of the courses and certifications they offer. And something I want to talk more about later, he was an incident commander during Hurricane Michael. And we want to hear more about what he did there. So his current thing is a VOAD member organization, and we'll explain to you what VOAD is. It's called the Disaster Logistics Board, and we'll send you the links and everything for that. But it focuses on mitigating and managing disaster supply chain issues. And Brian is the founder and the intelligence section chief. So, Brian, there you go. That's all about you.
Well, thanks so much for that intro. That was a great way to kind of take my bio and kind of condense it down. And, you know, that bio is... Obviously, it doesn't highlight all the experiences, the real experiences that happen when you're working in those types of roles. And it was an interesting transition to leave the infantry and start social work. Social work was, it became a passion of mine because when I got out, there wasn't, the VA was not doing as well as they are today. And they're doing a lot better, but supporting veterans in their transition. So I had a lot of difficulty in that transition. And I was actually, the first job I had right out of the Army was as a creative director for a marketing institution. So it was kind of in that time that I met another social worker from the VA. And I got really turned on to what it was he was doing for me. And kind of vicariously, I started living his life as I worked and became friends with him. And I just decided, you know what? Like, the money is great and all that stuff, but I realized that serving, whether that's my country, my community, or just, you know, humans in general, that's really my passion. So that's why I flipped over to social work. It was kind of a new uniform for me. And the same thing with Team Rubicon. Team Rubicon really actually gave me a new uniform in the sense of giving me a gray t-shirt and a new mission. And that, you know, you can take the experiences as a global war on terrorism veteran which really our generation is so adept at chaos management, right? Being a real wartime generation of military individuals, military veterans. So taking that experience and being able to apply that in a disaster is perfectly suited for a veteran, because we're used to doing improvise, adapt, overcome missions, right? And we're used to not showering necessarily or having all the creature comforts all the time. And most importantly, what we're really good at, especially those of us from the infantry side, is real critical thinking under high stress, high intensity situations. And that's how I got into this emergency management. And I'm a big nerd. I love school. I like writing papers. So that's why I went back for another degree right after that in emergency management. And I mean, to this day, I take Coursera courses from, you know, universities all over the world just because I like learning. And that kind of ties into what the Disaster Logistics Board is, how it kind of formed, and what our main goal is. So,
yeah, we're going to talk about all of that. Well, I'm the same way you are. I never like to quit learning. And I think lesson number one here is do what you love. You may make more money doing something else, but if it isn't as satisfying, you're kind of missing the boat. Would you agree with that, Jamie?
Absolutely. I think I've kind of made a career out of doing that kind of thing through my podcasts, through various journalistic efforts, and later through my writing. So I think that there are ways to blend your personal goals and needs with a career in many ways. If you can be a little innovative and creative with it, you can do that. And it sounds like Brian's done a good job with that.
Yeah, and I guess Kevin can say the same thing. He went from doing a lot of tech and security work to, you know, teaching wilderness and all of the things you're doing. So we've all kind of made that transition in a way. So, Brian, the first thing I want to address with you is you have an incident management assistance team called an IMAT, seeks to solve the second disaster. Would you like to explain what the second disaster is?
Yeah, absolutely. So in emergency management, the second disaster is a term that we use that describes the spontaneous donations and volunteers, the unsolicited donations that come into a disaster area of operations, that affected area post-event. And usually that starts happening pretty quickly. 72 hours is what I term the golden window. And it's really in those 72 hours, one, that what FEMA now terms lifelines. The lifelines need to stand up. So that's your, you know, health, your medical services, your power, your rest, you know, all those lifelines, they need to be touched upon as quickly as possible. and obviously, with the advent of social media and the integration of social media into our daily lives and the way that we interact with everything, whether that's another person or even any other type of technology or information out there, it's changed the way that people can get information and distribute information. So what that's kind of spurred, especially since what we've noticed is since Hurricane Harvey, is a large upswing of spontaneously formed groups looking to help out in disasters that kind of self-deploy themselves. So quickly, I want to say that that second disaster term is nothing new. It's been around for decades in emergency management. The issue that we've seen at the Disaster Logistics Board, and this is how it all kind of came together, was as we're in these disasters, working them at whatever level it may be, whether we're, you know, a deployed first responder, a professional emergency manager, or working with, you know, another VOAD, which quickly, VOAD is volunteer organizations active in disasters. So it's NGOs and nonprofit organizations that do disaster relief. So whether we're in those roles or we're sitting from afar and kind of monitoring what's happening, the ability to take social media and kind of get together and say, hey, listen, let's, you know, go to our church or, you know, a Kiwanis club or whatever it might be. Let's do a drive and let's go get these donations down to the people that need them. And with social media, people can also kind of pinpoint one where those donations could go to. So there's a little more planning these days. that's not to say that it's been a solution. But the point is that because of those issues and those abilities, there's been a lot more people that ingress into a disaster zone, which does become a second disaster. One, because we don't necessarily know what to do with all those donations. And second is the safety side. So those of you that are in the EMS side, you know that it's very easy to take an untrained person who is not necessarily equipped with the right safety training or equipment. They can easily become injured or a secondary casualty in a disaster zone. So that's some of the issues we're trying to mitigate right now.
Well, you make a good point there, too, because, you know, after a disaster, people want to help. But they're somewhat hesitant because they hear stories about if you go with this organization, they suck up all the money for admin and it doesn't get to the people that need it. And, you know, that's kind of a big deal. I think things would go a lot better if they had more confidence in where all of that stuff is going. And I can kind of relate to what you're saying about how this becomes a disaster. In 2007, we had the huge fires in Southern California. And I was with the state disaster team down there. Actually, it was our first deployment. And we were in a place that wasn't intended to be a shelter. So it didn't have all of the, you know, the pieces that make it run smoothly. We were actually at a raceway instead of another place. But it just trucks and trucks and trucks of donations showed up. And they would just drop them and everybody would run and go pick what they want. And like you say, there's issues with cleanliness. There's, you know, same thing with the food. It was just kind of a mess because nobody was really there to manage all of that. So, you know, anytime you can manage that stuff, that's a good thing. We'll get a little techie here. Jamie may have to create a glossary because it's hard not to. But looking at your core competencies, and I want you to kind of address these. First of all, you have data collection at pods.
So a pod is a point of distribution. So that would be a place that a individual could actually come and pick up supplies. And we like to make pods and emergency management that are managed a little more effectively. There's plenty of training out there on how to do so. And usually it's kind of like a drive-through. You drive through and kind of hit stations, you know, water, food, tarps, hygiene supplies, whatever it may be. And you kind of get some stuff thrown in your vehicle and you drive, you know, drive on out and continue on your way.
And not to be confused with podcast or PodMedic, by the way, kind of a different thing. all right. Get a little more techie. Disaster mapping or UAS.
Okay, so disaster mapping is one of our three main areas of focus. So if you look at it in a triangle, at the top would be incident management, which is what we're best at. That's what an incident management assistance team does. And the difference between an IMT, which is an incident management team, and an IMAT, incident management assistance team, is we're not managing an incident or a specific operation necessarily, though we can be tasked out to do so. That's what an IMT does. So what we do is we assist the organizations and individuals that are running an operation. So that could be a government organization like a state EOC or a county EOC, city. It could be a USAR team. It could be anything on that level. Or it could be an NGO or a small loosely formed organization that's trying to run a pod or kind of be a what we term an LSA, so a logistical staging area, which should kind of be a warehouse that would, you know, collect up all those supplies and begin to distribute them. So disaster mapping is part of what we call disaster intel. So coming from the military, we still use a lot of those terms. So really what it means is data, right? We're a very data-heavy organization. In fact, we have this quote that we love to use by W. Edwards Deming, who's one of like the top big data scientists out there. And his quote is, "In God we trust, all others must bring data." And we believe that's kind of the case, especially in emergency management. Again, emergency management is critical thinking under high stress, usually with little amounts of data, right? And those decisions that the real decision makers have to make, you know, the lives are at stake. So those decisions, you need as much data as possible to be able to make an informed decision. So disaster mapping, we do that through UAS, which is unmanned aerial systems that can be drones that are more like the mid-range drones that you might see out there, like the DJIs. So it's like the quadcopters, along with fixed wing and glider drones that can map for longer distances and give us aerial imagery. And then we have what we call SLP, which is street level photography. So that'd be like in Google Maps, when you click on the little guy and it zooms in, you're seeing it from the street and you're clicking through. We actually collect up that photography, and we do that via GoPro Fusion system, which is a 360-degree camera that shoots in 5.6K. And we're able to just drive through, just like you'd see the Google cars, with that one single camera, and collect an extremely rich data set that can be combined with the aerial imagery to create both 2D and 3D imagery models. And then taking all of that stuff and sticking it in a GIS system, like our partner that we use, Esri's ArcGIS, which is kind of the industry standard mapping platform, we're able to do spatial data analysis. So very specific application of that could be debris management. So with the photography combined together, we can more accurately and quickly determine the volume of debris that is on the ground in a given area. So whether that's a house or a lot or on a street, something like that, we can tell a government organization, this is exactly how much you have there. It's, you know, trees and power lines and white goods like refrigerators and, you know, some steel roofing and stuff like that. So they know exactly what type of equipment they need to send in there and exactly how many trucks they need to be able to remove that stuff as well.
Wow. We've talked about drones, but it's been a long time, and I know they've come a long way since then. Bet Jamie would like one of those.
Yeah, well, and, you know, so I'm curious, you know, this brings to mind all of the imagery we saw from the news following the, I guess, hurricane, would have been Irma, that hit the Keys and left all that debris washed up on the shore and the collapsed houses, or this past season with what happened on the Gulf Coast in the panhandle of Florida with the houses and homes hit there so hard and some of the communities just wiped away. So you're talking about really gathering the information on where the heavy equipment needs to go and what kind of heavy equipment will be needed just by driving through that community and gathering this data.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, that, so being data heavy, right? What that really means is that base level of very rich data, that data set can be used across the board. So in emergency management, we call them ESFs, right? So you've got these support functions, emergency support functions that are, you know, law enforcement and you know, mass care and utilities and all this stuff. So every single person, every single decision maker in those subsections needs to know what's going on out there. So the biggest thing that we're doing with that imagery is, at the very least, we're actually able to take someone who sits in an EOC, right, and is a command level decision maker, and put them into the field virtually. We can give them the same view as the USAR guy out there. Now, we could do that as a live stream, or we can do that as what becomes a historical data set. And they can actually view that in a bunch of ways, whether that's on a computer. They can do it with what's called augmented reality, which, if you guys have ever seen, like, you can hold up your phone with Google Maps and kind of look around with your phone in 360 degrees, and it will show you places like a restaurant you might want to eat at. So similar type of thing, we can tag data within those within the photography to do those types of things. Like, this place had a damage assessment. This place needs to be assessed for damage, right? This is a power line over here. So you can imagine with a DMAT or a USAR team coming in, knowing before they even get there of exactly what the hazards are, obviously, logistically, they're going to be able to navigate that scene and be able to more effectively manage that scene to complete their mission.
That is extremely cool. Well, I know if Kyle was here, he'd be totally nerding out about all of this. Well, Kevin's kind of a nerd, too. What do you think, Kev? You want one of those drones?
I'm just over here drooling.
I'll tell you.
I knew it.
The cool drone that we have that I know you guys would love to be able to play with someday is, so we're getting the DJI Enterprise 2 Dual. And that drone is a commercial level drone. There's some first responder agencies have gotten their hands on this and are starting to use it. So what it is, it's called Dual because it has side-by-side cameras in it. So one is a 4K camera. So extremely high resolution, and right next to it is also a FLIR infrared camera. And they can actually be tied together via the software to give extremely high detail forward-looking infrared imagery. So you can imagine in a search and rescue operation, we're going to be able to see people that may be trapped or are navigating around. I mean, that can be used for animals and the animal rescue. You know, you've got teams out there trying to do that as well. Along with being able to see live power lines because they're generating a lot of heat. So we can identify a lot of stuff with that single drone. The other side to that drone is it's modular. So what that means is there's actually attachments that can go onto it modular. So one of the attachments is a very large floodlight that, well, the output is very large. It lights up like 5 kilometers. So we can see out there. We can do a live feed of that. But the other one that you can stick on it is a speaker. The speaker is extremely loud, and we can do recorded messages, or we can talk to someone live. So if a USAR team is there and they're trying to get ahead, we can get in front of them and say, hey, you know, the team is coming, rescue is coming, please stand by, please try and get on your roof, please, you know, leave this part of the area, whatever, something like that, whatever it is to assist that team and again, help complete that mission.
Oh, that's freaking awesome.
Talk about nerding out. Wait till Dr. Joe hears about this stuff. I don't know how much he knows about it. But, you know, here's some real alphabet soup, Brian, that I'd love to have you break down for us commoners. Incident management assistance at GEOINT and BOG support for BDCTs. Go.
So GEOINT is geospatial intelligence, which is essentially means mapping, right? Now, it's not just a map, right? Like, think about when you guys are using Google Maps on your phone, right? When you see that map, when it pops up, before you've even put a destination in that, you see where a gas station is. You see where a restaurant is, right? And then within that, let's say you want to look for a restaurant. And you know specifically, well, I think I want Chinese food tonight. Okay, good. And then you want to get more specific. Well, I don't just want a Chinese restaurant, but I want a Chinese restaurant that doesn't have MSG or something in it. You can, with that data tagged to a certain place, it allows it to be searchable. That's spatial intelligence. So the geospatial intelligence is one of the key factors in the data set. So BOG is actual people and us being on scene to be able to support a VDCT, which is a volunteer donations coordination team. So those are teams sometimes that are government-led or NGO-led that are helping to manage actual supply warehouses or a point of distribution. So that's us being there physically present to provide both technology and equipment for organizations. So that could be giving them custom-made apps on the fly to collect data and also to inventory and sort through data, so that, sort through donations. So that obviously allows them to expedite the process, along with helping to manage the volunteers that are there as well. You know, a lot of times the spontaneous volunteers will show up and they're just like, hey, I'm here. I brought this stuff and I really want to help. I can give you 48 hours. Give me a task, right? when you have 20 to 40 people show up at a place and say that, it can be a little bit overwhelming, and people can sit by the side and get a little angry and then possibly wander around the disaster area of operations looking for something else to do, right? And again, that can lead to a lot of issues. Whether that is the kind of becoming a secondary casualty or secondary injuries, but most importantly, in a disaster area of operations, that area already has taxed transportation systems in the sense of most roadways are going to, there's going to be closures, there can be washouts, there could be, you know, it's flooding still around, so that's going to prevent people being able to get around logistically, along with the fact that the priority, especially within that first week, is allowing first responders to move around. And the more civilians you have on those roads, the harder it is for guys that are, you know, code three, trying to move around that that area and try and get to real emergencies that they know they need to get to. So that helps to manage that side as well.
And that's going to wrap up this episode of the Disaster Podcast. I want to thank all of you for checking out the program this week. We actually are going to split this episode into two pieces because Brian just brought a lot of great stuff to chat with us about. And we wanted to make sure that we just didn't keep you here like for a super long time. So we're going to wrap this episode up here. I do want to thank our sponsor, Paragon Medical Education Group, for their continued support of the program. Check out their awesome experiential training programs and educational programs available for you. You can find out more over at paragonmedicalgroup.com, over at ParagonMedEDU on Twitter, and of course you can always find links to them in the Disaster Podcast site at disasterpodcast.com. Thanks again, and make sure you guys come back and check in for another episode with the rest of this episode next week on Thursday, as always. And in the meantime, remember that your disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.